and leave a bit more time for questions. Sometimes when people ask me questions, I can think about it in a new way. Otherwise, it's slightly tedious just saying the things I've said in a book, because I've spent ages writing it. anyway, there you go. That's my problem, I know, but I kind of want to enjoy this as well. Okay, I wanted to say something just briefly again about this practice of mindfulness, which, you know, I've never heard this word mindfulness talked about so much. When I first came along, nobody had ever heard of it. Now it's, you know, there's things in The Guardian about how mindfulness can be bad for you and all that sort of thing. I could give you the web address if you're interested. So let's try and be a bit clearer, if we can, about what mindfulness is. Actually, you can't be that clear about it. So the first thing to remember is mindfulness is something you do. Often it's something you frankly forget to do. By you, I mean me. At least you don't have to keep on telling people you've written a book on mindfulness. Every time I forget something, I say, and I've written a book on mindfulness. So mindfulness is something you do. It's often something you forget to do. Don't worry about forgetting to do it. Just use forgetting to do it to start doing it, if you see what I mean. As soon as you notice that you've forgotten to be mindful, in that moment you are actually being mindful. Yeah? So even if you've just forgotten to do whatever it is that we're asking you to do in terms of mindfulness, as soon as you remember that you've forgotten to do it, you are now mindful. So let's focus on the positive, you know, and start from there. Yeah. The other thing I wanted to say, particularly about these breathing spaces, is try to notice this whole kind of attitude of whether you think it's working or not. Somebody in my group was saying, oh, sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. So it's completely natural to think in terms of working or not, but try not to, if you can. Even if you think it works, the trouble is, as soon as you think it works, you set up, it won't work. Do you see what I mean? As soon as you set up, oh, that was great, I felt really relaxed, and that therefore worked, what that means is I bet you next time you'll decide it doesn't work. So it becomes another thing that doesn't work. Yeah. So you're not trying to train in becoming relaxed. It'd be nice to be relaxed, but being relaxed is a consequence of practice, not it's not you can't practice it. It's something that comes to you. Yeah. What you're trying to train in is mindfulness. The first elementary way of training mindfulness, I say this elementary but doesn't quite do it justice because it suggests that it's easy and you can get on with other things. But the first practice is to notice your mind going off in prapuncha, which I think I've said is a driven, associative mental chatter, something like that. Planning, fantasizing, remembering, catastrophizing, etc. Thinking, I'm so wonderful, whatever, whichever way you do it in your mind, and you'll do it in habitual ways. What you're firstly trying to do is you're trying to notice that, and you're just trying to step out of that into your body sensations. Like, dead simple, yeah? I mean, dead simple in theory. I mean, you can do PhDs in mindfulness now, but hey, it's not that difficult. You know, you notice your mind going off into prapuncha. You step out of that into your direct experience of your body. You can't think your way out of that. As soon as you think, I wish I didn't think so much. As soon as you think, why am I thinking like this? It's just more of the same, yeah? As soon as you think, does it come from my childhood? That's just more of the same. What this practice is doing is just saying, you just practice noticing your mind, doing its thing, going off. And that's not a problem you've got, your mind going off. That's what all of our minds do, myself included. You practice noticing that and you practice stepping out of that into your direct sensations of your body. Sometimes that will feel like it makes you feel more comfortable. Sometimes it'll feel uncomfortable. Some of the reasons why we so get stuck in our thought is because we're actually just emotionally uncomfortable and our mind's trying to find a solution to that, yeah? So just practice stepping out of it. That's what you're trying to learn to do, not whether it works or not. Because as soon as you create works, you create doesn't work. Yeah. Even if you have this lovely experience, just try and think, okay, that was a lovely experience. Next time it could be quite different. Otherwise, you sort of set yourself up to have more of the same kind of problems in a way. Watch out for sort of frightening thinking like, I can't do this. Oh no, I'm doing that thing where I say I can't do this. I'm not supposed to do that. I can't believe I'm doing that again. Oh, I'm doing that again. I'm not supposed to think that. I'm not supposed to think that. I'll do it again. You know, you can, once you're into that kind of self-frightening kind of story, what's wrong with me? Oh, is it this? Oh no, I'm not supposed to think what's wrong with me. What am I supposed to do? You just get more and more of it, don't you? Yeah. Is it to do with my child? Oh no. You know, try and notice that tendency. So many of us have it now. That kind of self-problematizing, hyper-analytic tendency. I was talking to somebody in the tea break saying, as soon as you get into that analytic mode, why, what, how come, I bet you're going to go down a negative way. I say this because I've got experience of it. You very rarely analyze yourself to get into, oh, why is that so good? I think it's so good because of that. No, actually, I think it's more good because you never do that with analysis, do you? It tends to be, I bet you there's something wrong. So as soon as you set off into that analytic mode, why am I thinking this? Where does it come from? Where will it take me? I bet you've got underlying that an assumption it's a problem. If you're in a good mood, you don't do it, do you? If you're skiing, not that I've ever done such a thing, but if you're skiing, I can vaguely remember it, imagine it, and it's going well, you don't analyse why it's going well, do you? That shows you that it's going well, is that you don't analyse it. So as soon as you notice that analysing, discussing mind, just try and step out of it for a while. Just start to practice that stepping out of it into, yeah, but how does that feel to get into that mode? That analysing, deconstructing, dreadful word, mode, has become kind of almost epidemic with many of us. And it's going to take you into a problem, I bet you. So see if you can just, at this moment, practice stepping into noticing I've got that thing. How does that feel in my body to have that kind of mode? Yeah. So that's the first thing I want to say really about this practice of mindfulness. And I think I've said it in the book, but the practice of mindfulness is just starting again. So you notice you haven't been mindful, and you just practice starting again. You start practicing being mindful again. Yeah. So before I go on to this week's presentation, is there any questions about anything from the first, you know, this first section of integration? Yeah.
So you say, like, as soon as, or whenever you realise that you're not being mindful, you should try and be mindful. Is that really, like, whenever? Because obviously sometimes we're trying to solve problems, right?
Yes, that's right.
Especially at work. Like,
yes, that's right, yeah.
Problems.
Yeah.
So, it's like we can't be mindful at that point because we're trying to solve a problem, we're trying to work out, trying to make plans.
Indeed, yeah.
And obviously don't want to get rid of all of that.
No, indeed, yeah, yeah.
Be mindful all
the
time.
This is why it's good not to have people asking questions. Because then you think, oh yeah, that was nonsense. Anyway, yes, that's right. I mean, there's nothing wrong with problem solving. What psychologists call what we would say perpuncture is aberrant problem solving, where you can't get out of that mode, where you're trying to solve problems that, like things like the problem of being unhappy. That's a very abstract, very unclear what that problem is. If it's a problem of why did my computer stop sending emails, which is what I had the other day, yes, you need that problem solving mentality. Nothing, problem solving is one of our great human skills to do that. The philosopher Karl Popper thinks that we're actually problem-solving animals, that's what we are, and that's why we've developed so much. It's just that it gets out of hand. It goes into areas of life which it's not appropriate for. So there's been, for instance, lots of studies about lawyers. They're much less happy. They're one of the most unhappy groups of people. So, sorry if there's any lawyers around. They're the highest paid and the most, for their wage capacity, they're noticeably less happy than other people. They think it's because it attracts people who've got a pessimistic mindset. It'll attract you if you've got a pessimistic mindset. Lots of things attract pessimistic mindsets, but being a lawyer actually uses it. You capitalise on your pessimistic mindset, which means you're a better lawyer. Some lawyers here are looking worried. So what they think happens is that it uses your pessimistic mindset. You get really good at being a lawyer, but then it spreads into the rest of your life. So you have that pessimistic mindset about your relationship, about the dog, about getting the children to school. It spreads, yeah? So yes, you're right. When you're problem solving, make sure you really are solving an actual problem. As soon as you get into this aberrant problem solving, where you take that mode into abstract things like, why am I not happy? Why does this always happen to me? Those kind of catastrophic problems. They're not problems. That's something quite aberrant, if you see me. That's different to saying, okay, why is the sink blocked? Which is what I also did yesterday. That's a good problem. You have to, no, that's right. You try and work out why that is. I didn't manage it. But yeah.
Can I just ask a question relating to that? So surely in that instance, if you're
problem
solving, you're not problem solving about your direct experience at that moment. At work, I might still have stuff that I think about, but it's not stuff that happened 2 weeks ago.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that's right. I mean, partly what happens is that this language of mindfulness sounds like what you're doing is kind of detaching yourself from life and kind of being mindful of it in this slightly detached way. Actually, when you're working, for instance, if you're working on something positive, including positive problems that you're solving, you're actually very mindful in that time. You're often very absorbed. Like they've done all these happiness studies, and often people are happier at work because you're very absorbed. That's what psychologists mean by flow. So mindfulness is like that flow happening all the time. But you've got the flow happening when you're walking to the tube, you've got the flow happening when you're communicating with someone. You're living very richly in that flow. What it can start to sound like is you've stepped out of all that to sort of detachedly notice it. It's not like that. Quite difficult, really, to get a sense of what mindfulness really is. It easily looks a bit alienated to me when people talk about it, as if you're sort of weirdly separate from your experience and sort of experiencing it one remove, as if you dare and get close to it. It's much more what you're trying to do. One way of talking about it is that often you have experience without awareness, don't you? But you can, if you're not careful with mindfulness, have awareness without experience. I am now walking to the tube, mindful me, you know. You start to feel that sort of strange robotic sense. What you're trying to have is awareness saturated in experience. Awareness and experience saturated together. That's what we're all looking for. To be living deeply and valuably and to be fully alive and aware of that. Rather than thinking about stuff in our head. Rather than, why am I not happy? What's wrong with me? Rather than some fantasy of success and all that sort of thing. We're trying to live deeply, really. And the language of mindfulness doesn't really quite evoke that, but that's what it's really getting at.
Yeah. In the first chapter, you quoted Keats, and
then
you talked about the negative capabilities.
Yeah.
I wondered if you could elaborate on that.
Yes, I liked quoting Keats. It's always lovely to... It's a very famous quotation, so it's not easy, difficult to do. What Keats talks about, I can't remember where I wrote about, but he talks about negative capability, which is really this capacity to do nothing. I was thinking for this week, this could be something that you could do this week, is see if you can have some times where you do nothing at all. So negative capability is where you don't have somebody drilling upstairs. It's slightly getting on my... Anyway, I'm having to work with that. We will try and... negative capability is where you notice your mind doing its stuff and you consciously just stop and do nothing. It seems to me one of the most radical things you can do now is to do nothing at all. because everything is trying to get you to buy, download, etc. So in negative capability, you're trying to just stop and experience what you're actually experiencing, just letting it be there. Yeah. Now, when I do that, like I was doing it the other morning, one of the first things you hit is boredom. And what it's easy to do is just bounce off boredom into buying something, doing something, sending an email. It's very easy to get bored. But actually, try to then just experience boredom. Boredom is often a threshold experience, where you're going from ordinary consciousness into the potential to a deeper consciousness. Sometimes if you sit and do nothing, you can be bored for a bit. Gradually, a new kind of consciousness arises, very quietly, very naturally. But negative capability, you're not trying to do anything, you're not trying to impress yourself on anything. When I go on retreat, I experience that most. And how I experience it is that the natural world around me, it sounds a bit sort of spooky, but it's almost like the natural world starts to pay attention to you. That's what Keats thought, is that if you didn't try and impress yourself on things, you just let life come to you. You know, suddenly you start to hear the birds' song, the trees. You just try and let everything come to you. But you have to wait, sometimes a long time. But nowadays we're so quick to do, act, download, share, like, that we can't get into this different mode. Very rare now. It's the mode of reverie, really, where you just sit there, do nothing, and you let yourself get into reverie. You can't do that if you've got your phone on, because there's a part of you waiting for a text or waiting for the phone. So see if you can this week have some experiences of just doing nothing. Get yourself a cup of tea, look out the window, and try and resist that urge to do anything. Like do it this Saturday morning or a Sunday when you haven't got anything to do. Get yourself somewhere. If it's sunny, get yourself sitting outside and just keep... What you'll find is you'll want to get up and do something and keep just, you know, resisting that urge. And then you'll feel bored and then you'll feel a bit irritable. Then you start thinking, oh God, I'm so tired. And then you think, oh, this is so boring, but so good for me. And then, then you're thinking, I don't care, I want an ice cream. And you know, but gradually all that starts to change and you start to experience new energies arising. If only you can wait through that threshold. Yeah. So yeah, that's what I meant by what Keats means by negative capability. And then he'd write great poems out of that, but you don't have to do that. Great if you can. So anything else before I move on? All perfectly clear. So what we're doing in these first 4 weeks, really, as we were saying, is developing this fit mind, a mind that's fit for purpose, fit for the purpose of living a valuable, fulfilling, worthwhile life, rather than just thinking about stuff in your head. That's basically what we're trying to do. Or just being prey to negativity, inner criticism and so on. We're trying to live that the life we wanted to live, we've always wanted to live. We don't mean not to live a valuable life, we just get distracted by stuff. Yeah. So the first part of a fit mind is this question of integration. It's important to emphasise that integration isn't a theory, it isn't a... it's not a theory, it's a sense. You definitely have times in your life. It's not even a great word. None of these words really quite fit the case. No words quite fit the case. But there are times, aren't there, in your life where you just feel more clicked together. You just feel, oh gosh, that's good. You just feel more unified, more whole. All that's a rather slightly banal language. But you flow with things better. And it can be in the midst of great activity. Like, you know, I live upstairs with in a community with Yonav Archer and all my friends. And, you know, we try to run the centre. And sometimes it's like the West Wing, if you ever see, except for we don't have that budget. But, you know, we're trying to run actually quite a large centre with not very many of us. With lots of, you know, at the moment we were trying to plan for the opening. We've now got this problem with the floor in the retreat centre, what we're going to do about. Lots of things happening all the time, emails coming in. And at times I get this lovely sense of just flowing into things. All this stuff going on, going over to John Rochester and looking at that email that was just written. So I say, well, he talks to me about what we should do about that. I say, I just need to check with you about that. Will that happen? At times you get this lovely flow where you just feel, this is just sort of, it seems easy. I remember when I set up a Buddhist cafe, helped set that up, sometimes working on the counter, you just get into this lovely flow. Sometimes it'd be like horribly difficult. Sometimes you get into this lovely flow. So integration has got this sense of flow to it, this sense of being in charge of your inner agency. Instead of sort of having that horrible, broken up kind of a prey to things state, you feel that you're actually flowing along in life and you're sort of guiding it all, but like a current, you're not over-guiding it, you're just guiding a current of your energies. It's very satisfying. All of you have experienced it at times. You might experience it in sport, for instance, where you're just flowing into the game. You don't need to think about it very much. You might experience it after reading a novel. That sense of everything coming together, flowing together naturally, that sense of well-being that comes with it, of unification and so on. That's what we're trying to develop. That's the first thing we're trying to develop. It's that human state. It's very embodied. It's not thinking stuff in your head. Yeah, sounds sort of straightforward enough, but crumbs, there's quite a lot to do even with that, isn't there? Because there are so many things now preying on our attention. So there's this what I want to call a horizontal element, where you just feel what I've just said, all of those things unified and so on. You take responsibility for your life. One of the signs that you're integrated is that you're trustworthy. It seems to me one of the most important qualities about someone is not whether they've got good jokes, not whether they're da-da-da, but whether they're trustworthy or not. I'm very lucky in my life to have friends who are trustworthy. You can only be trustworthy to the degree to which you're integrated. Otherwise, nobody knows how you're going to behave. You know, one moment you're all sweetness and light, the next moment you're heavy-handed. That's because you're not integrated, yeah? So what you're looking to be is a straightforward, trustworthy human being. On the basis of that, you can form relationships, you can form friendships, because you are pretty much the same person all the time, a unified person all the time. You can be trusted. You won't say yes one day and then actually change your mind the next. That's what integration brings about, a kind of trustworthiness. And you can start to trust yourself more. As that starts to develop, you get this other aspect of integration, which is, I've called rather clumsily, vertical integration. So, but what that by that I mean that sometimes there's another kind of thing happens, which you can't account for. We'll come on to this more later on in the course. But sometimes into that sort of horizontal integration erupts forces that are beyond you a bit, yeah? In my book, I couldn't quite get the metaphor right, but it's almost like our self sense of ourselves is like a little raft on the floating on the sea. And usually that's who we think we are. That's usually who I think I am. I get trapped in that little me that I'm so worried about, trying to protect, trying to enhance, trying to get things I like, trying to avoid things I don't like. Sometimes, though, you get a sense of, good heavens, there's this incredible depth of the ocean and all these beasts in the ocean, whales in the ocean. Sometimes you get this incredible sense of a starry sky above you. And sometimes those things break into you. I was talking to somebody just earlier about experiences about breaking in. In the book, I talk about an experience when I was still at art school. I was at Goldsmiths and I went on a romantic weekend to Paris, which didn't work out as being very romantic, but anyway, we'll leave that aside for a moment, but do ask me about it afterwards. this was around about 26 or something. And at that age, by golly, do you want them to be romantic? But we'll not go there. Distract myself. Anyway, I went and looked at this painting by Cezanne in the Dorsay, just a painting of apples on a tablecloth, one of these still lives. And as I looked at it, I seemed to disappear from that little raft of me and experience both this incredible depth and this incredible height. And it seemed to be mediated through the picture, or rather it seemed to be something to do with the relationship between me and the picture. It was completely undeniable. I seemed to go into another wholly expanded field of consciousness, which I didn't recognise as belonging to me. I mean, that was just one experience. I've had other experiences like that. When you touch those kind of experiences, they have a kind of magical sense to them, not in the cheap way, but in that life suddenly feels incredibly meaningful, endlessly kind of opening and valuable. It's kind of what you always wanted of life, and then it closes down again. And if you're not careful, you try and get it back, and it doesn't work like that. Of course, what most people try to do to get these kind of states is through drugs. So you'll smash and grab raid on those states. And I've tried that as well. That was quite a long time ago, but I remember on LSD having a sort of similar experience, but it was opened by chemicals and then just closed by chemicals, and I didn't sort of develop it. I didn't create it. I didn't create the foundation for it. So when it closed, I never got it back. But this experience with Cezanne, I think I might have had a coffee. and perhaps a croissant. I was in Paris after all. It was unwanted. I didn't will it. And it wasn't on the basis of smoking something. All of us want those deeper experiences, don't we? If we're not careful, we'll never get them because we're just trying to finish our emails, either in our mind or actually on the computer. So this is what I call sort of vertical integration. Sometimes it can be, it might happen very subtly. Often on retreat, for instance, you get an element of this coming in, but you don't notice it very much because you're so integrated horizontally, it doesn't disrupt you very much. Sometimes it's very disruptive. For some people, it can be very disruptive, at least for a moment. Sometimes it's very, you know, just some people get it more than others. It's not something to get hung up on. But it's a sign that there's more to you than you think. And all of this practice we're doing, this mindfulness practice, is to try and have more of life than you think, isn't it? It's not to try and be a good, mindful person, valuable though that might be. It's to be, to experience more to life than you thought there was there. More to yourself, more to other people, more to the world. That's the whole point. Otherwise, I'm not very interested in mindfulness, unless there's a reason to be mindful, because there's something more that I'll get from that. I'm not very interested in it as for sort of well-being reasons. I mean, I probably sort of should be, but I'm not personally very interested in it for those reasons. So that's what we're looking for, is this horizontal integration, which is through the practice of mindfulness, stepping out of puncture into direct experience of the body is one way, simplifying your life, practicing mindfulness in your life, so as your mind can start to quieten down, so that, to change the metaphor, all the surface of your mind starts to quieten down. The more it does that, you can start to see through into the depths of your mind, and you can reflect the heights of your mind. That's a better metaphor. That's what you're trying to do with mindfulness. At last, I managed to say it. You're trying to get that whole surface layer of your mind, which actually isn't a very important part of your mind, trying to get all that just to quieten down, straighten out, smooth out, so that the depth of your mind starts to become palpable to you and the heights of your mind start to become experienceable to you. If we don't do that, if you and I don't do that, most likely we'll just get caught up in the surface. Yeah, that's what most people do a lot of the time. I do it and you do it. Yeah. So that's what we're trying to do. And that's why we're trying to step out of propuncture Not because, you know, problem solving isn't a good thing to do, but because we want more from life than merely problem solving on that literal level, especially if we're problem solving things that can't be solved at that level. Yeah, so that's what I mean by, I think what I mean by vertical integration. So that's our first thing. We need to become integrated, unified rather than distracted, whole rather than dissipated, having more of a sense of our own agency, that we are living our life. It's not that our life is doing stuff to us. I mean, I literally have met people who say, yeah, I'm really, really a kind of chilled out, relaxed person, but life keeps stressing me out. You know what I mean? Or you are driving me mad, whereas what you mean is I am irritated. So often, we don't really take responsibility for our life. We say, you make me do this. You have made me late. I was unavoidably delayed, which really means I didn't leave early enough. So mindfulness, the first practice is about taking responsibility for your life. It's about ownership of your life. It's about this sense of being unified so that more can start to be revealed to you. Okay, so before I start to say how we might practice this week, is there any questions arising from any of that? Or have I just sort of confused the matter more? Yes.
What happens if taking ownership of your life is bearing on the negative side? Like you say, you mustn't be negative and you mustn't. So if you want to take ownership of things that you've done wrong, how do you not do that and still be doing the right thing?
How do you not
do that and still be doing the right thing?
Well,
I don't even know what the question was.
I don't completely, but I'll have a go.
you,
they often do. I'm like that as well. I think, well, when in my head it was sounding fantastic. I mean, part of it is, part of mindfulness is actually being able to think, oh yeah, I did that wrong. That was
so
my
it's
fault.
Okay to do that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that's right, because you said I'm late, but I'm not admitting to being late.
Yes, instead of you made me late,
right.
Or I was unavoidable, you said, I'm really sorry I didn't get up early enough. But what you're trying to do is do that without guilt. You're trying to sort of say, yes, what you're trying to do is say, that was my fault. I'm sorry about that. I was late. That's made it more difficult for you. Part of this, part of being a trustworthy human being, I think, is being able to say to someone, sorry, I've messed that up. And I can see that's made it more difficult. In other words, an integrated person is someone who starts to see that my actions have an effect on other people. Mm-hmm. Often people can forgive you if they can see that you are aware that it's having an effect on them. Mm-hmm. So yes, some of it is saying, actually, that, yeah, I did that wrong. What you're not trying to do is obsessively go into that. You say, okay, yeah, I did that wrong, really sorry about that, make amends, okay, now we move on. When it gets problematic is when it's got guilt in it, which means I'm always probably wrong, somehow wrongness is what I am. That's guilt, because that's nothing to do with an event.
Mm.
What you're trying to get is, when I did that, that was wrong. But you're not saying I'm wrong, or I'm inevitably in the wrong. That's actually guilt. It's interesting there's no etymology of the word guilt, which is in itself an etymology. Nobody knows what it is. It's like a disease. Yeah.
Not necessarily guilty about, but ashamed of.
Yeah.
I feel like, as you're saying it and describing it, I'm feeling like, oh, that's really hard.
It is, yeah.
And I just wonder if you could say something about that. How do we make it easier on ourselves and get past that
yes.
barrier?
I mean, I always have to think of my own personal example. So I've got one. So I went to see my partner was going in to possibly going to see a surgeon to have a hip replacement. And his appointment was at 1. I got there like 2 minutes past 1. He'd already gone in. And the whole point was to go so I could make sure he didn't say, no, it's fine, you know, pretend not to limp and all that kind of thing. And I felt so ashamed of myself. You know, I'd even decided not to do something else I was going to do so I could be there. And it was just greed. I was trying to do another email. Sorry, I have to talk like this in the break. It's only the truth. You know, we've all done it. You have it. And I don't even want to do those emails. It's just, I'm in that mode, and I let it leave in time. And I felt so ashamed of myself that I'd missed that moment. And I was even, it was too painful to actually say, look, I felt so ashamed I couldn't say it, you know. Now, the shame, from a Buddhist point of view, is a positive mental state. I was right to feel ashamed of myself. And I was sitting there in the waiting room thinking, okay, let's not get into guilt, but what has happened here? Because this isn't unusual for you. This is me talking to myself. What happens here? Why do you do this sort of thing? This, you know, this is important. How come you've let this happen? Now, what I could do is get into a big, oh, I'm so terrible, which then just means that it's all about me. Actually, no, I have made a mess here. So you need to feel the shame, and it's painful shame. I mean, it is actually really quite, I felt, mortified by my own actions. Such a, it's horrible, you feel such a twit. So it's really important to feel that without going into guilt and perpuncture, oh, I'm so rubbish, but without evading that either. Actually, that's a practice in itself. Then you try and think, okay, how am I going to change this? How am I going to learn from this experience? One of the ways we don't learn from experience is to make a big drama about it in our head, which makes it all about poor old me again. So here I am, I've done something wrong, as it were. How am I going to learn from this? Yes, that's painful, but that's how you learn. Guilt is something quite different. Guilt is where you just think, I'm inevitably wrong. Guilt actually just becomes another self-drama. But yes, it is painful. Shame is very painful. It can be, like, on this particular occasion, I found it mortifying. And I jolly well should do. If I didn't, that wouldn't be a good thing. This is what I mean. But you see how the language of mindfulness could easily start thinking, well, you, oh, it's not about, don't feel that, step out of that. But actually, no, I was right to feel that. But that means I've got to start changing my life so that I don't feel that. Yeah. And that's mindfulness as well. Yeah. Much better with an example, isn't it? You can make more sense of it. Unfortunately, they're always so embarrassing.
I'm starting to find that I'm not into great finding stretch of the imagination, but the more you find yourself becoming more trustworthy, or trying to be trustworthy and horizontally integrated and having slightly deeper experiences, actually the more painful life actually seems to be, because you suddenly sort of have this, I don't know, like sliding doors moment where you just think actually everybody's horrible.
Yeah.
And nobody else is integrated.
Yeah, that's right.
It's
yeah.
just kind of really painful. And I think, given that we're never going to be perfect, constantly practicing it and having to go through that painful experience, you sometimes think, I don't know how to do this. Actually.
Yes. Getting drunk might have been better after all. But I think that's a very definite stage in spiritual life where you get these times where, I mean, I remember it very clearly. I remember going out for this meal with people and I just thought, this is just rubbish. You know, basically one person was showing off for a bit and everybody was waiting for them to stop. Then somebody else would show off for a bit and everyone was waiting for them to stop. And I just thought, I can't join in with this. So I just got more and more quiet, you know, and everyone was getting a bit drunk. I just thought, this is just like horrible. It was just so rubbish. And it was probably, you know, a week before I would have been doing that as well. So it can be quite a bit painful. That's one of the reasons why you need a sangha, why you need people who are also trying to develop that, so that you can say, this is rubbish, isn't it? And they say, yeah, how are you? You know, actually, let's talk instead of do that thing that we can do where one just, you know, shows off, really. So I think that's not uncommon. It's a sort of, that's why you need friends who are also practicing. You can't do it on your own. It's just too difficult. You just think, well, I might as well just get drunk as well, and it's much easier. And you go, oh, wow, is that lovely, we loved it.
I wanted to ask a question that more or less expressed the exact same point that was made. The question I wanted to ask was, are there some ways you can stop yourself from becoming indignant and affronted by fragmented behaviour around you?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
In you having addressed the point you just addressed, doesn't that make it quite a kind of a binary experience? I either have to embrace the sangha and dive in
or I live in misery. Yes. Not a great choice, is it? No. I mean, it's interesting that experience of indignation or being aloof. I remember going for a bit of time where I suddenly got became Mr. Spiritual. You know, and I mean, I couldn't keep it up. You know. aloof, indignant, da da da. Actually, all of that's just causing yourself more pain. I mean, partly, I mean, one of the great challenges of our life generally, and we'll be coming onto this next week, is the problem of loving other people. One can never decide whether other people are lovable or not. Because sometimes they sort of seem, oh, they're fantastic, and the next day they think, they're a nightmare. You know, everyone is always shifting and changing. I mean, I just the other day I was sitting with someone saying the challenge here is to love them somehow. And, you know, that's what we'll come on to next week as part of positive emotion, is that one of the huge challenges of life is how to love people, which doesn't mean just agreeing with them, liking them. It's something much more than that. And yes, at times that's a bit painful. But also, very often the things we're reacting to in others are what we do ourselves. Very often you see somebody, and it's actually they're just doing a more overt version of what you do in your head. So you know that sense where someone's seeming to be very special and you really dislike it. Actually, it's because you do it a bit more politely in your head. You don't actually say, I'm fantastic at this. You just think it. And then if somebody else says it, you think, so often indignation points at you, I think, to try to learn from that. But you see, even as you start to actually think about like life instead of mindfulness, you start to see how demanding this practice is to respond to all these with a creative, productive, aware kind of mind. And that's what mindfulness is trying to do. But yes, you need friends who are also trying to do it. You can do both, but you need both. Yeah. It doesn't need to be binary. Here you are now, so you're doing both now. Or at the moment, at least for these 8 weeks. Anyway, look, time is running out, so I need to tell you what to do. I can't remember what I said to do. Oh, yes, I remember. Do nothing is one of them, yeah. So number one this week is doing nothing. I mean, I do really recommend that. See if you can, between now and next week, try and have 3 times where you do nothing at all. I mean, the only thing you're allowed to do is have a cup of tea, or likewise, you know, decaf, coffee, etc. Just do nothing. Just try and sit there. But try and sit there for at least 1/4 hour, if you can manage it, 1/2 hour. And try to feel yourself stepping through all those layers. First of all, slightly, you can feel your body wants to move. Then you get into, what am I doing this for? It's like so boring. And then try and then feel bored, and then try and keep just waiting. This practice of doing nothing is really a practice of waiting, except for you're not waiting for anything to happen. If you've got a garden, just go and sit in the garden and wait. And what you find is if you wait long enough, gradually the garden starts to turn towards you. You start, the birds even, because you're not moving, birds come back. And so on. Just try and keep stopping. You know, if you've got children and you just put them to bed, and it's all been like, oh my God, then go and sit out in the garden. The instinct is to put the telly on, isn't it? Because you just want something nice. Try and see if you can just go and sit in the garden or sit in your room and just wait. Just keep waiting. So that's one thing to do this week. Try and do that 3 times, yeah? It's really radical. No one out there is encouraging you to do that because everybody wants you to be part of the market economy. The second thing I'd like you to try and do is turn a walk that you do in your life, walk into the tube on the way to work, whatever it is you do, into a mindful walk. I've taught this so often, actually slightly gets on my nerves. All I mean by this is you use a time of walking to try to particularly practice this first level of mindfulness, which is stepping out of puncture, mental proliferation, into the physical movements of your body. Yeah. So that might be the first 10 minutes of your cycle ride. You know, it might be your walk to the tube. But what you're going to do is you're going to use that time just to consciously come back to your body. Yeah. So that's just you doing a bit of training. Not so that you have some experience, not so that you feel good, not so that you relax. Just start, so you start to train yourself in this stepping out of mindless chatter into the body and its movements. Yeah. So try and turn one of your walks into that. So try and do those two things. So you've got three times of doing nothing, and then you've got this mindful walk. Try and do your mindful walk every day. You might want to carry on doing the breathing space every day, three times a day. You might want to not do that. You might want to just do that. All you need to remember is the principle that I've taught you about mindfulness. How are you going to put that into practice? You might think, I'll do the mindful walk, but I won't do this doing nothing thing. That sounds awful. So I won't do that. I'll do the mindful walk and I'll do the three breathing space. So make a choice between those three things. And what you might like to do, and you might not be able to do this week, but you might want to be able to do this sometime in the next 8 weeks, is gather a few friends, two or three friends, and put an evening aside to tell your life story. It's one of the things I suggest in the book, is that you tell your life story. Weirdly, you can know people for ages, and you never get to say what happened. It's very strange when you think about it. But you can know people for ages, and you didn't know all sorts of things about them. It's part of our tradition here, is that quite often on retreats, when you're on teams, we tell our life story. When you're in the community, we tell our life story. What telling your life story does, at best, is it helps you integrate yourself. You tell the story of who you are, and you try and tell it as honestly as possible, without blaming other people, including without blaming yourself. You just try and say what happened. And when you tell it, the first times I've ever told my life story, I experienced a sort of unification. I sort of owned my life a bit more. Now, I want to sort of give a health warning with this. You need to do this with people that you trust. This is why, again, you need trust friends that you can trust. Friends who know what you're trying to do. You don't, when you say something honest about your child, you don't go, don't start to freak out. Again, you need a kind of context of people in which you can start to be frank about yourself, and which you can be honest about what's happened, so that you can be aware of it, yeah? Otherwise, their reaction to you makes it more difficult to integrate it. Do you see what I mean? Sometimes what you just need is to say, here's what happened. Very often that's what we can give other people, is just to listen to what happened without adding our own story to it, yeah? So if you can, if you've got people in your life, perhaps people come to the centre, just organise an evening or whatever, where just two or three of you just go around and have an hour each or something like that and tell your life story. A simple way, I've given sorts of ways of doing it in the book, so I won't go through them, but it can be really very integrating. You just say, well, this is what happened. This is who I am. These are the things that show up to me. This is the story I have. One of the things that's interesting about life stories is that as you tell them, your life story changes. So I've told my life story many times, and it's now really quite a different life story that I told when I was 25, when I first got involved. My story then was all about my dreadful brothers, and they were so bullying, and they were very cruel. And indeed, they were cruel. But I'm not, somehow I'm not interested in that anymore. When I tell my life story, it's just a different life story. As you change, not only does your present change and the future changes, but weirdly, your past changes. Starts to change. Your perception of what your past has been starts to change. Particularly, it gets less blame heavy. You start to see your own part in it more. Yeah. So if you can, see if you can get a few people together, friends of yours, and just say, look, let's just do this mad Buddhisty thing. I'll show you what it says in the book. It's a bit mad, but hey, I just thought it's like a really good idea. Like, we don't do it, we never talk about stuff. Let's do this. And let's just do it, try and be really honest about what our life story has been, yeah? And see if you can do that, yeah? So you might do that sometime in the next 8 weeks. But that's a classic kind of integration practice, yeah. So you're trying to take ownership of your life. Okay, so what I'd like us to do now is just turn together to in twos or threes and really decide what you're going to do this week. Are you going to do the three breathing spaces? If so, did you do them last week? Can you do them this week? If you're going to do the mindful walk, are there any issues with that? How are you going to do it? When are you going to do it? Are you going to do it walking to the tube in the morning or walking back? Try and keep it really realistic. If you're a 20-minute walk to work and 20-minute back, then no way will you manage to be mindful through all that time. So let's do the first 10 minutes. It needs to be about 10 minutes, 15 minutes max, yeah? Make it really realistic. If you might want to carry on a mindful meal, which meal? Make it really, really specific so that next week you can say how you got on with it. All this stuff we're exploring, unless you practice it, it doesn't really matter. It just sounds great, but we've got to put it into practice. Then you can come back next week and you'll have more questions about what it actually means on the ground. Because that's where it's going to count, is when the rubber hits the ground, isn't it? What actually happens when you try and do it. So let's have a bit of a think together in twos or threes, how you're going to do it this week, so that you know that you've done it or not. Yeah.